This is The Naked Scientist with Chris and Ben, and we're going to be joined now by James Ost, and he's from Portsmouth University, and he works on memory. Hello, James.
Hello, good evening.
Thank you for joining us on The Naked Scientist.
My pleasure.
Your speciality is false memory, but before we get on to false memory, let's talk about true memory. Mm-hmm. What actually is memory, and how does it work?
Well, that's a rather large question. okay. Essentially, there are a number of kind of ways you can think about memory. Some people think about it as a kind of store in our head where we put facts and things to retrieve at a later date, much like you kind of put books in a library, if you like. Other people think of memory more as a sort of tool we use to help get us around the world. So we use kind of memories as sort of stories to remind us of how we got where we are and where we're kind of going next. So there are kind of a number of different ways that psychologists certainly think about kind of memory anyway. So there's not a kind of clear answer to that one, I'm afraid.
So in sort of put simply, you take information into your brain and it's in some way converted into connections between nerve cells.
You can think of it like that. That would be certainly one way of doing it. That's a very kind of reductionist kind of level, yeah, for sure.
And when you get the memory back, effectively those nerve cells, are they recreating or replaying in your brain the sensation that the original experience would have given you? Is that how it works?
No. That's a very kind of popular view. That's kind of referred to as a video player analogy, okay? And in some cases, say if you're retrieving facts or, you know, things you've rehearsed an awful lot, then yeah, indeed, it would be like the kind of nerves replaying, if you like. But for kind of more complex things like sort of autobiographical memory for episodes in your life and things like this, we know that memory isn't a literal replay at all. And in fact, as your previous guest was speaking about in terms of memory, in terms of music and memory, we know that memory is a kind of reconstructive process, and we sort of fill in lots of kind of gaps as we go along. So
how do you know what we're filling in? Because that's a really interesting point, isn't it? People think that their memory is infallible. A lot of people think their memory is infallible. And we think, this is what I remember it, so it must be true. How do you work out how much the brain's filling in the gaps for you?
You basically have no idea. There's no kind of clear way of knowing. Psychologists at the moment are kind of looking at a number of techniques to see if there are any, if you like, kind of clear markers of what one might call true recall versus what one might call false recall. Okay, but even at the kind of, even at that kind of psychophysiological kind of cellular level, it's almost impossible to distinguish these things. People have looked at people remembering real things and people remembering imagined things and essentially measured their brain waves, if you like, and compared the two. And really, any differences are very, very short-lived and disappear within a matter of kind of seconds.
So how do you define a false memory then?
Well, again, a number of kind of takes on that, right? The term actually false memory was first kind of coined by one of the forefathers of psychology, an American guy called William James, way back in 1890. And he was basically making the observation that a lot of us will be able to relate to, that memories kind of go wrong. You know, we forget where we put our car keys, so forth and so forth and so forth. But real contemporary interest in that phrase, false memory, has only kind of really come about in the last 20, 25 years or so, in relation to kind of cases of recovered memories of kind of abuse and trauma in childhood and things like that. So
there was quite an interesting study I read, though, James, back about a year ago or so, and scientists in America got a bunch of students and got them to fill in some questionnaire and then said they were going to give them feedback on what they got from the questionnaire.
Sure.
And then they invented the feedback and they gave the same feedback to every single student and told them when they were little some strawberry ice cream and made them violently sick. And then they retested them later.
Yeah.
And then a large number who previously had not reported any kind of allergy to strawberry ice cream then said that strawberry ice cream made them ill. So it was almost like the researchers had planted a false memory. How does that happen?
Oh, well, again, that's really interesting stuff. And that kind of research you're referring to is really at the kind of forefront of research in this field at the moment. But how does it happen? Well, again, what we know is that memory is a kind of constructive process. Okay, it's not just like pressing play on your DVD and everything kind of coming back. So when we're asked to remember something, essentially we kind of take information that we do have to hand, you know, bits of true memory, bits of things we've seen, bits of things people have told us, and we weave these all into a kind of a narrative, a memory, if you like, okay? And so when people suggest things, like in the study you're referring to, that as a kid you got sick using eating kind of strawberry yogurt, yeah, this partly gets kind of woven into your kind of your autobiographical memory, if you like, your narrative. And there is research that's shown that, you know, people are more likely to avoid strawberry yogurt, as, you know, after having received such suggestion. But again, that, I say the research is in its infancy. It's very interesting stuff.
And just to finish off, James, can you just tell us, how does this impact on, say, criminal proceedings? How do we know that someone's account in court is reliable?
Right. I mean, that really is the kind of the $64 million question. I think there's a lot of work at the moment, certainly over the last sort of 5-6 years, on these DNA exoneration cases. Okay, and these are people, a lot of them on death row in America, you know, on death row for having committed certain crimes. Later, subsequently, it turns out that DNA evidence shown they could not possibly have committed the crime that they're on death row for. And researchers have looked back at those cases and found that in 80% of those cases of DNA exoneration, the most convincing piece of evidence to the jury and the judge and everyone was a faulty or mistaken eyewitness testimony. That is, someone saying, yeah, it was definitely, it was James, he was there, that's the kind of fella. So, I mean, these kind of memory errors, like forgetting your keys and forgetting where you park your car and all these kind of things, really are the minor ones. They really do kind of range on a full spectrum all the way up to these kind of cases of people being, you know, wrongfully imprisoned for things they haven't done. So it really is a kind of important issue to, you know, it really does have quite important implications.
Which is why we should be looking at it. Thank you very much. That was James Oss, and he's from the University of Portsmouth.